truth in the public square, there we are. The first thing is to notice the public nature of truth. By its very nature, truth, objectivity is public. If I succeed through my cognitive structure, my attentive, intelligent, reasonable mental operations in coming to know truth, I go beyond myself to what is true, objective for all. I reach the being of things beyond myself. So truth is by nature, it's public. If I know there's a certain mountain in the Rocky Mountains in Canada, I've found that out, but that's available for everybody else to know. It's not just something that I know, and I may be the first explorer to find that mountain, but it's a fact. It's a fact of what is there. And I come back and tell people, and it's not just my truth. It's mine in the sense I'm the first one to discover it, but I'm telling them, if you go there, you'll find the same thing. So that's the necessarily truth is public. Of course, people can get confused about all this and fall into one or more types of relativism, skepticism, where we just looked at the self-destructive nature of certain types of skepticism. And again, the Greeks say, the skeptic gets involved in self-contradiction. Just about skepticism in general, well, skepticism, if it's any worthwhile, it has to be reasonable. I mean, if somebody says, I'm a skeptic, they're not just saying, well, they're saying, I'm a skeptic. What do you mean by being a skeptic? Well, I use my intelligence and reason to question whether that's so or that's so. Well, okay, but then your skepticism is relying on intelligence and reason. And so skepticism has to be reasonable. I can be an unreasonable skeptic. Then I'm not being intelligent and reasonable. I'm just, I really doubt if this screen is here and you're there. I mean, the aliens could be making us say, yeah, but what's the evidence? It's again Occam's razor. There's absolutely no evidence, and all the evidence is, all the reasonable evidence is that you're sitting there and the screen's there. And literally, it would be silly, because it's so unreasonable, to think otherwise. So skepticism, it's an exercise of reason. Skeptics try and convince people by arguments of reason. So they themselves rely on reason. They attest to the power of reason, to the truth-finding quality of reason. They can't escape that. This kind of relativism too, this is the kind of confusion we see. Socrates, right back in the beginnings of Western philosophy, great philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, they were dealing with all this. It's not, this is something that I say to my students, one of the great lessons in studying philosophy is, well, it's not exactly you find there's nothing new under the sun, but it does take, one of the things that, again, in our modern world is, somebody's just come up with this wonderful idea and it's on YouTube of some, I'm sorry, that idea was thought of already in 1423, and it was also thought of in 500 BC. There's nothing new about it at all. This is a kind of an adolescent thing, isn't it? People just, it's sort of, I don't think C.S. Lewis had this phrase, but it's a bit like one of his phrases, pastism. We're meant to be avoid all sorts of isms that are meant to, if we're good and woke, we've got to avoid this ism and that ism. But one of the big sins of our times, I think, elephant in the room is pastism. We tend to think that because people didn't have mobile phones and TikTok in 1800 or 1700, they must have been really thick, and dumb and stupid. Whereas, if you study the works of Aristotle now, something written 300 years before Christ, there are still the scholars and the Aristotle scholars and the philosophers are still struggling with Aristotle today. This is something somebody wrote almost two and a half millennia ago. He certainly wasn't thick. And how did you think you get the mobile phones? It's through centuries of far more intelligent people than you inventing things and discovering things, the gradual accumulation of this knowledge. So, philosophy takes off this luster, and you see rather philosophy itself testifies to this common human nature back across centuries, back across time. They may not have had iPhones yet, they might have been better off for it. But there's human intelligence, the human nature, so, you know, questing for truth or fleeing from truth, committing sin or being good, that's the story of humanity across all times and all ages. That's the common thing we share, and that's part of what can liberate us by studying these things, not just think that everything is just us, you know, in our little bubble of the last 20 years and the way we see things. So when you look back at the ancient Greeks, you see them arguing against this kind of relativism that people throw around in the media and popular nowadays. So Socrates had to deal with this relativism in confrontation with the sophists, figures like Protagoras, Gorgias, and he showed that their views were contradictory and self-refuting, just like we saw earlier. Gorgias and Protagoras, they were saying, oh well, you know, there's no objective truth. What we have to do is just to educate the young men of Athens, give them good education for a good price. We're going to charge them, and then we'll get them to sort of debate in the public forum, become good politicians. They were teaching what we did call recently spin doctorism. They were teaching how to be a good politician for a good price. You know, and Socrates said, "Well, you're taking money off these people for nothing." And one of the things that, you know, we go all his arguments with them, but fundamentally. The self-contradictory nature of relativism, as Socrates showed up and followed this, philosophers who followed him took this up again and developed it further, it can be seen when we think of a principle in our thinking, a non-contradiction. As St. Thomas says, there are certain principles in our minds that are per se nota, they're born in us. You know, when we talked about cognitional theory, we are, as human beings, unlike my lovely dog I have comes to visit, Minley, a beautiful fox red Labrador, I love her. I'm not allowed to say it, but my wife says, I don't love the dog, I'm fond of the dog. I love my husband, but I said, oh, that's very kind of you, dear. I love the dog, so I'm fond of the dog. Sometimes I think she might get it around the wrong way. I love the dog, I'm fond of my husband. Anyway, I love dogs, I'm a great dog lover, but I see that the differences between us and them, so I can illustrate it for my philosophy classes. In us, there are certain principles we're conscious of. Think of when we try and make a judgment, assess the evidence. That's born in us. Children ask questions. You can't teach a child to ask a question. Sadly, if a child has some kind of, there's some sort of mental problem. You can educate people's questions, you can help them to develop their questions and skills, but the very activity of questioning is something that's innate, is inborn in us, just so our ability to assess the evidence, you know, in the courtroom, there might be no evidence at all, there's no evidence for that. Well, there's a little bit of evidence. How do we do that? We're not, you know, you can increase people's ability to use their skills and so forth, spend a lot of time studying jurisprudence and practicing whatever, or other, you know, in education you talk about transferable skills, but you can't make human beings, you can't give them reason. Those principles are innate. Unlike mainly the dog, dogs do have a kind of reasoning and so forth, can't get into all that, but just for the long story short, they don't rationally assess evidence in the way we can. They don't have insights into mathematics and geometry, or don't write symphonies and all that sort of thing. So we're born with certain principles in our minds, in the way it can grow. And one of these principles is non-contradiction, and that's just, we can unpack it and say, if A is true, then necessarily not A is false. If I say A is true, then it means no way out of it. Not A is false. I can't have it both ways. It's impossible. If I claim A is true, then I mean not A is false. And that's a principle of thinking. It's a principle of reality. Even if I try. So you can't have it both ways. So if you say, like this kind of thing, my truth and your truth, this is just what the sophists were saying in ancient Greece. If I say all views are equally true and good, then that's a self self-destructive statement. All views are equally true and good is a self-destructive statement. It's incoherent. Why? Because by saying it, I have to rule out as false the view that not all views are equally true and good. So you have to rule out a view. You wanted to say all views are equally true and good, but by doing so you had to rule out at least one view, the contrary of your view, that not all views are equally true and good. So you, it's impossible to have it, have your cake and eat it. Eat your cake and not have it. You know, in order to say all truths, I've got to rule out at least one view, and that's the view of the person that, well, they're not all equally good and true. So these views are self-destructive. Similarly, cultural relativism is another sort of type of relativism, isn't it? Oh, well, there are different people. And Sir Thomas was well aware of this in ethics. He said, you know, and he knew about that, cultural relativism. Different tribes, different people, different cultures at different times, they do different things. And the ancient Greeks knew about it. You go down the road to the Spartans, they've got a totally different view of the gods and the culture and morality from us. You know, that's what they thought. I mean, they're always communalities. But so cultural relativism is not new. It's not, people are being aware of that. But you see, of course, people say, oh, well, you know, in this culture, of this place, this time, they think this and that, and we think this and that. But cultural relativism, and then people run from that to say, oh, well, you see, it's just relative to what's true and false, and good and bad is relative to the, what's true and false is, but it's just relative. But if you think about it, all relativism has to base its argument on the claim to objective truth. So I've got to, you know, I make the objective truth claim, yes, there is this culture, and they really and truly think this, and they really think truly that, and there really is this culture, and I'm in it, and I think this and that. So that's a claim to objective truth. So you've got to, even to start your argument for cultural relativism, you've got to claim that I can reach objective truth, because I'm claiming to reach objective truth about these people at that time and place have that view, and I have that, you know. So again, cultural relativism depends on, you know, you can't even start the argument, or the beginnings of the argument depend on you claiming to know objective truth, that there really was these people at this time and that and thought this and that. So these types of relativism, if they are denying my ability to know objective truth and that there is objective truth, are all self-contradictory. They're self-destructive. This tape will explode in 5 minutes, John. they have self-destructive things in them. A communal enterprise. Does Aristotle, here we've got some dates, Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas observed, I was trying to find the texts for you, but I remember them talking about it somewhere, Aristotle and Aquinas following it, but I couldn't find it. Human beings have to collaborate in the pursuit of truth. There's just little old me, and I can't do it all. Human beings have to collaborate in the pursuit of truth. We see this in ordinary life. The knowledge and wisdom of one generation is passed on to the next. It's from that basis that the next generation may add to, improve, or correct what came before. We all, as the famous medieval thing, say that we all are like pygmies standing on the shoulders of giants. We all depend on what happened before. This is also the mystery of God's creation of human history. Knowledge increases over the generations. We can't find it all out ourselves. We see this in the arts, the sciences, the world of applied sciences, and scholarship. People have to spend some years in studying and training, and then also collaborate with others. So, you know, you've got to be somebody who works in the area of academic area of physics or history. You have to, you know, do the usual thing, go with the people who are qualified, get the right degrees, do well, and then, you know, get a job in this community of scholars, of historians, or archaeologists, or physicists, or whatever. And then as you work with that community, you collaborate with them. You depend on you trust the results of their little field of work they're doing. You think you've got every reason to think they're being honest, trustworthy, and then you do your patch of work, and you publish in the journals, and then it to be peer-reviewed, so they won't publish anything unless some other experts who are suitably qualified have read through what you've sent in, and they say, okay, this is okay, and it's also is a bit of a contribution to things that somebody else hasn't done before, and then you publish, and other people, other scholars in your area or scientists in your area will critique your work and say, well, there's evidence for this, or he's missed that. It's a collaborative activity. Human scholarship, you know, is a collaborative activity, and it has to be so. And we may know many things firsthand. I know I'm standing here now, and that's the lectern, and I know quite a lot of things firsthand that I've found out, and even maybe things that I've researched myself and found out, all sorts of facts I know about small things in life and big things in life that I've found out personally. But many, many, many other things that we rightly claim to know, we in fact believe. Without belief, we would all have to start again fresh from the caves. We're depending on other people. We're trusting the information from other people. That's something, again, in this great work of Newman, The Grammar of Assent, published in 1870. That's his most philosophical work, Newman, and he talks about, you know, how, like, belief, or he's trying to show how human knowledge, how religious knowledge is not dissimilar from a lot of other areas of human knowledge. So it's kind of an apologetic, because he's saying, well, don't think that people say, oh, religious belief, oh, they're just all off in the fairyland, because belief is something that's part of the texture of society, it's part of the texture of all sciences. We all have to believe things, but of course, we use our, when we start off as children, little children, we trust our parents, but then we learn to assess things ourselves, and we learn to try and assess, well, you know, okay, mum and dad love me, they have my best interests at heart, I can sense that, I know that, so if they tell me things, this and that, you know, that I'll burn myself on the fire, I'll trust them, I might try it myself one time, oh, it's true. But if they tell me, oh, well, you can go and see this man down there, he's called Dr. such and such a thing, and that's, you've got a headache or a bad pain in your leg, we're taking you there, so you learn gradually to trust these people called doctors that your mum and dad trust. And then as you grow and learn about society, oh, there are doctors and they have to do all the studying, they qualify. Hopefully the person I'm going to see is one of those qualified people. Of course, we read these incredible accounts, oh, you know, this person is a fake and that sort of thing. But in a sense, we're surprised about it because we wonder how they got through the system, weren't they? I know we've all got worries about the way the NHS now is, problems and complaints, but that we complain and whatever on the basis of the fact that we think, well, they're all meant to be professional people with professional training, and the system is meant to work half smoothly, and it doesn't. So even our complaints and worries are based on reasonable trust in what this institution is meant to be and the people who start and so forth with it. So Newman points out it would be literally foolish, even for someone in Victorian England, to say they're not certain that Britain is an island. So we talk about degrees of certainty, degree of probability that Newman talks about. But that person, how does that person come to know this firsthand, or through the reasonable trust placed in evidence from others? So I mean, obviously now we can fly over the whole British Isles in, I don't know, half an hour or something, or see it from a satellite. But even if you're a person living in 1870 or the 1860s, they could be certain. Human said that Britain is an island. I mean, why, from centuries of people travelling in boats, they may have gone apart across the water themselves in one direction, and then all these maps that were drawn up by mariners, information over the centuries. So it would be silly not to say I'm certain that Britain is an island, even in the 1860s. But that comes from many people, unless you're a sailor or a fisherman at the time, trusting the accumulated knowledge of many other people, as Newman said. So as we grow from childhood, we learn how to develop skills for intelligently and reasonably trusting others or not. This is the great area of authority discussed also by St. Thomas. St. Thomas says, you know, there's an argument from authorities. And Thomas says it is the least strong of reasonable arguments, but he still says it's an argument from authority, because if the authority is rightly to be trusted and reasonable, that, of course, that's a question that we have to learn to assess as we grow up and we learn move in certain areas of life, then we are right to give weight to the deliberation of the authority. I go and see the doctor and he tells me the problem with my leg is from such and such and such a thing. I think I have every reason to trust him. Now, I may have got the diagnosis wrong, but it is reasonable to think that he knows what he's talking about. I've got reason not. I just did somebody in the sweet shop down the road and say, to the lady at the counter, I've got trouble with the pulmonary artery or something like that. What do you think? You know, it's not quite as wise as to at least consult the doctor. Although there are plenty of jokes. Anyway, we haven't got time for too many jokes about. So there's this guy, it was my friend Monsignor Terry in America who told me this joke years ago. He said, there's this guy in America and he had this terrible ringing in his ears. So he was terrible ringing in his ears, he doesn't know what to do. And so he went to his local doctor and he did a battery of tests on him. He said, I don't know. He said, it's not the usual thing, he said, it might be. This ringing in your ears, I'm going to send you to the consultant of the local hospital in the city here. So he goes to the consultant and he says, they do some more tests. They say, we don't really know, but this is pretty worrying. We're not really sure, but I'm going to send you across to another state. So you fly over there. There's this national expert on this. I'm going to book you in for some tests. So he flies off to another American city and goes for his tests, stays in the clinic a couple of days. They do all sorts of tests. And the expert says to him at the end, he says, Mr. Smith said, we're not absolutely sure, but he said, I'm sorry, but it looks like, as far as we can see, you've only got 3 months to live. So the guy said, okay, it's a terrible shock, he's distraught, he's not a married man. So he goes off and he thinks, okay, well, I've only got 3 months to live, I'm going to set up my house, I'm going to go on a world tour, I'm going to do things I wanted to do for years. I'm going to go on a world cruise, and he buys his tickets and he starts to get himself ready, 3 months to live, tells all his friends, there's no crying. So he said, I'm going to get myself some really nice suits and things before I go on this world tour. Some new shirts, things I really never usually buy. So he goes down to this expensive tailor in town and I'm going to have these shirts made for me. Never done this before. So he goes up to this guy and makes the shirts and he measures him all up and everything and he says, I'll have a 16 size collar. He says, 16 size collar, sir? You're 16 and a half. So he says, no, I always have a 16 collar. I want a 16 collar with your shirts. Yeah, it's my money. I want to see, sir, you are a 16 and a half shirt. And so he said, no, 16. Just do that. He said, okay, sir, but I'm warning you. If I give you a 16 size shirt, you're going to have ringing in your ears. There we go. Right. Monsignor Terry, that's your joke. Right. Subjectivity and objectivity. Another confusion which we find, which also has roots in what happened in Western thought and culture over some centuries, has to do with subjectivity and objectivity. This can sometimes manifest itself in terms of people talking of their interests or talents being now more in the arts and humanities, I'm into the arty sort of things, or on the other hand, the hard sciences, physics and chemistry, biology. The latter are in the area of the hard objective facts, whereas the former have to do with subjective feelings and emotions and deep personal insights. Of course, there are differences between different areas of human research and knowledge, but there are also things which have very much in common. So there is being subjective in the wrong sense, as opposed to exploring or thinking about or talking about our own subjectivity. So in therapy or spiritual direction or marriage counselling, for instance, we should want to be objective, not subjective in the wrong sense. Here, this girl's having spiritual direction. We don't go to a spiritual director or counsellor, we shouldn't, to somebody who, will just pander to our feelings, emotion. We need to know the objective things about ourselves. We should want to be objective, not subjective, about our emotional life. That will do us no good at all. So there's this confusion that if I'm talking about sort of counselling or art sort of things, then that's all subjective, whereas the science is all kind of hard objective. No, human objectivity and subjectivity is a matter of intelligence and reasonable judgment, whether it's applied to archaeology, physics, or what my motives are, and this again is an area, we know, flight from truth. You know, that people can flight from insight. They can, you know, sitting down in the pub and they're trying to tell this fellow that he's not treating his wife well. And, you know, he kind of half sees it. That's when we can flee from the truth. We can sometimes be totally ignorant of something, or we can have something in the horizon, the conscious horizon, but I don't want to face it. I can run from it. And that's where there's a moral thing involved too. I can be totally ignorant if somebody tells me something, but I can also, when I'm fleeing from the truth, I'm aware, I'm having a bit of insight myself, and, oh, no. So, you know, the friends sit around and tell him that he's really not, he laughs at all, that's because she's like that, and she always says this, you don't want to take any notice. So he's running from the truth. So to know about my feel, you know, myself, my conscious life and everything, I should be objective about that. That's what, you know, spiritual direction and going to confession, examining my conscience is. And that's what, you know, when we think about conscience, it's I'll just follow my own little conscience. Great, well, good on you, Hitler, you know, Stalin, go ahead. You know, the conscience is part of my, you know, we talked about the three levels of coming to know facts. As we'll mention this evening, if you like, there's a fourth level or a fourth phase of the moral question. Well, now I've come to know the facts, what ought I to do about it? Okay, this crash down the road these two fellows are discussing, it's actually somebody bashing into the side of the thing in a car. Well, that's what it is. Now we know the truth of what's happened. What ought we to do? That person might be hurt. Maybe we should miss our train. There's not many people around it. Miss that train and run down and help them. That is a car. So we have to come to know the truth, the facts of the case, before we can ask what ought I to do about it. But then there's another phase, and that's where we ask what ought I to do about it. What's true? What's truly good? That's the whole phase, the fourth level, if you like, of objective finding out what's morally right, what's morally good to do. What ought I to do? And that's knowing that moral truth, what I ought to do. And that's, you know, my own spiritual life, my own psychological life. I'm only going to have healing or improvement if I get to know the truth about, the objective truth about myself. Okay, this is little old me, but I need the objective truth about it. So that the one psychiatrist goes and says to the other psychiatrist, this is my diagnosis of him. It's objectively true, because he's saying, you know, if they're right. So it may be about my little internal world, but if he's got the diagnosis of me right, then it's objectively right for the whole psychiatric community, for the whole world. It's not just because it's little old me that it's subjective in the sense that, oh, that's not objective. So a lot of that kind of happens to this confusion over subjectivity and objectivity. But in both areas, you know, whether it be physics or spiritual direction, we need attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness to know what really is the case. What's wrong with that person or right with that person? What's true about this subatomic particle theory, or what truly happened at the Battle of Waterloo? It's all the same objective truth that we should be after. Reformation, Enlightenment, and shifts in public discourse. Sometimes it's important too, philosophy and culture and so forth, to understand a lot of what people think we think today, to understand the history of our culture, and philosophy plays a part in that. It's somewhere in St. John Paul II, Fides Oratio, the great encyclical. It says somewhere in that philosophy is often like a mirror of the culture. Philosophy is the mirror of the culture in which it lives. It's, I mean, philosophy is just a matter of the culture in which they're in, but often they do reflect things going and, you know, affect also the culture that they go through. So that's part of, you know, where do we get to today in our culture and our times? Sometimes we need to understand the history of that and the way that philosophies and various cultural forces played a part in getting to where we are today. So there are various ways of approaching. There are other thinkers we could talk about, but and forces. But I've looked at this side of it. So with the Protestant and the Reformation, one of the things that happens is we have this kind of rejection of the Catholic Church, the magisterium of the Church. So there's sola scriptura, we just follow scripture there without the teaching of the Church. Sola fide, and that's, oh, it's just my faith without works. You know, in Luther and so forth, faith is without works, I'm saved by faith and works. And philosophy was rejected because it was considered a work. So many of them in the Reformation, not all of them, rejected philosophy, partly because they thought it was a pagan kind of thing that had crept into Christianity, but also because it was works, it was me doing something. Also because the Protestant idea of original sin is that my mind is so completely dead and that the reason is no good. The Catholic view of original sin is that, yes, my mind is wounded, but it's not dead. So this enters culture, this very subjective attitude to faith comes about, and it's called fideism. So faith alone without reason. And this means that you've got a breakdown in the Catholic vision of the Middle Ages of the harmony that you see in St. Thomas between faith and reason. There's an independence of reason, but there should be a harmony between faith and reason, because they both come from God, the creator of all. And this tends to break down. So this is one strand. I mean, we can also talk about Descartes, but I'm just highlighting this part of the story, I think, that's there. This kind of stress on faith alone, without reason, as opposed to reason, that enters into Western society and culture. And, you know, when you get to the new atheism that we'll talk a bit about later, this is the sort of idea that the caricature of Christianity, well, of course, what happens is you say Christianity as a whole, whereas what you're saying might be true of some part of Christianity, but it's certainly not true of Catholicism and other certain traditions. So, and that is fideism. Oh, well, they believe in any old silly things. But the Catholic, and the more you believe it, the more virtuous they think they are. But the Catholic idea of faith and reason is not that at all. Our reason is God-given. It's wounded by original sin, but not killed. So we have reasons to believe. So, you know, we use historical scholarship and so forth and argue, yes, we have reasons to think the Gospels are historically reliable, that Christ worked these miracles and so forth, just like the Church have today and for many centuries has done, has reasonably assessed whether this is a truly miraculous case in order to canonize saints. So we look at all the ways we might explain this event away, and reasonably, we can't explain this this event, and so we have a reason in other ways, so we have reason to think this is a miracle, and that enters into the process of canonizing saints, or reasonably, is this person possessed? Modern Catholic exorcists have to make, as they always have, had to make every use of every psychological or whatever thing that they can to exhaust the idea that this person is mentally disturbed. But there are cases which, okay, now we really can't explain this. You know, this person has superhuman strength, speaks languages that they never learned, and all these other things. And this, we have reason to think this is a demonic possession. The Catholic thing is reason, as well as faith. Now, faith is a gift of God that takes us, so reason, we can make arguments for the existence of God, how does this world exist, it doesn't create itself, and all those kind of things. We can make arguments for the truth of the Gospels, we can make arguments for the truth that these saints really did work miracles, they weren't just, you know, stories or legends. So reason can take us to the threshold of faith, but the gift of faith makes us step across. But when we step across into faith, we step across into great mysteries, but those mysteries aren't absurdities. They're not like believing 2 and 2 is 7 or absurd things. Rather, there is a darkness in faith, but that's because God's wisdom, his intelligibility, is infinite. So I have reason to I have reason to take the hand of my father as I'm a child, but my father will lead me to places that I may not understand myself yet, or may not, you know, where he's leading me, but I've got reason to put my hand in his hand and trust him. But, you know, what I trust through God's gift to me of faith is not the belief in stupid, absurd things, but in profound things that are so profoundly wise that at the moment in this life, it's like St. John of the Cross says, I'm blinded, I see darkness because of the sheer power of God's light in me. And that's the Catholic view. So this idea that, faith is anti-reason, which plays into a lot of things right from the 18th century on, that enters into a lot of Western culture. At the same time, all in the history of Western culture, then in the 17th and 18th centuries, you have increasingly this kind of Enlightenment thinkers like Hobbes, Voltaire, Diderot, Hume, who are actually anti-religious, increasingly claim that only the sciences, which are developing more and more during centuries, and of course sciences are focused on material reality, they're the only ones that give a true objective knowledge. All this faith, this subjective stuff, that's just all people's weird feelings. They probably need a bit of therapy or something when you get to Freud. And so this is the kind of world that comes, that we've inherited. That, as I say, sorry, I don't want to put this 18th century image as the world of the clock. Everything's fixed and set forever. Science will tell you how it's going to go on, that the clock ticks. And when we look at this new atheism of the 21st century and then the postmodernist reactions to it, there's nothing new at all. It's simply the playing out of these two themes that we can see developing over the last few centuries. Subjective feeling, non-objective, be my little personal religion over here, with objective, hard, fact science over there that has no room for God. And people swing between one and the other over the last 2 or 3 centuries. Little subjective faith feelings down here, the hard scientific facts and material reality, there's no room for God over there. Just talking about this, the public domain then, during these centuries we increasingly see the public square influenced and formed by new mass media. The printing press, born in Catholic Germany in the 1400s, of course, again this is a bit of an old chestnut, a Protestant, God bless him, of apologetics. Anybody who think the Protestants invented the printing press? Actually, in the late 1400s, because it's in Wittenberg and in Mainz, the German bishops in the late 1400s were paying them in Mainz to produce German translations of the Bible. That's in the late 1400s. One of the old Protestant apologetics was, we kind of invented the printing press and we gave people the first vernacular translations of the Bibles in printed form, which again is a bit of a legend. The printing press becomes more and more effective, more efficient, more technologically advanced, and there's an increase in the development as we go to the 17th, 18th century in a middle class who can read. We have to remember, a lot of people could read, in this country, the Education Act was 1870, which dictated that young children should receive some sort of education in numeracy and literacy. That was only in 1870. So a lot of ordinary people couldn't read anyway up to
that time, but increasingly there was a middle class as you move into the 18th century, the Industrial Revolution, merchant class, and you see the emergence of magazines. Here's Gentleman's Magazine of 1759. So there's an increase of public, you know, media influence. And of course, this is the beginning. It accelerates through the 19th century. And as we get to our own times, the public square is filled by newspapers, magazines, and then by radio, television, and the internet, and so forth. And this is all this public discourse, and people have to take this in and live in that world of mass media. That's a phenomenon of our time. The communal search for an embrace of truth. As I say, unlike angels, we have to reason to get the truth. But since finding and living by truth is a communal matter for us, we need discussion and even debate in human community. This should be done in a virtuous way, but given our fallen nature, debate often leads to hatred and often violent division. We need grace to correct that in ourselves and in society so we can debate. What was it Chesterton once said? The tragedy of a... I can't get his words. The tragedy of a... I can't remember. Yeah, I need the right word. The tragedy of a violent argument is that it puts an end to a healthy debate. you can have a healthy debate, and if it leads to a violent argument, then it just destroys the debate. I'm sure he put it much better than that. So there needs then to be freedom for a reasonable discussion and search for truth. Think of the community of scientists or scholars. The document of Vatican II, Dignitatis Humanae, on religious freedom, is sometimes misunderstood as allowing a kind of free-for-all in society. But this is not so. We see the affirmation in that document several times that freedom of different religions or other views in society have to be in accord with the common good. There isn't a freedom for views which are against the common good. I think that sometimes needs to be thought through a bit more when Dignitatis Humani says that. These things have to be, it doesn't mean you're free of any view in any religion. I mean, if there's a religion that actually says, well, you should go around killing children, then you're not free to have it in a society because it's against the common good. So in that society, in that public space, we need a natural law as the common basis. Otherwise, we would just have tyranny and chaos. That's not true human freedom and debate. So there have to be common grounds for agreement on what can be debated and the way it's debated and discussed and so forth. But we can look a bit more at that natural law, the common good. We're going to have another session on that. So there does always have to be some kind of censorship in society that is justified and reasonable on the basis of natural law. Not exposing children to certain things, and the young, and pretty much everybody agrees on that, unless you're in some strange little groups. So there is some restraint. We're not free to publish libelous claims against others without any, comeback. We're not free to publish in the newspaper or put on saying, oh, this person, he's an adulterer and he's a murderer, because that's my freedom. No, we're not free to do that. It's unfair and unjust and unreasonable. So we rightly have regulation of law based on reason, on the reasons, and they should be based on the natural law for why with certain things we're not allowed to just come out and say them on the internet or say them to people that are not legal. So there has to be certain censorship control in society. But when censorship is pursued in the name of lies, or the denial of reason itself, then this is a defamation of the public sphere of truth. And this is what the problem we're getting into, well, have been for some years now. Unfortunately, we see this manifest in many places today, not least even in the universities, which should be a place for reasonable and rational discussion. We can see the outing of professors and the closing them down in the name of woke causes. The closing down, for example, of debate by intimidation and bullying, cases such as Professor Kathleen Stock of Sussex University author of Material Girls on the cancellation of an honorary doctorate for Germaine Greer. Now, these people, Catherine Stock and Germaine Greer, well, Germaine Greer, not so much. You know, Germaine Greer is wonderful. You have to be very careful. You have to have a bleep button when she speaks, because every other word is a rather unpleasant expletive. She hasn't changed in that regard. But she is a very feisty, just as she always was. She wrote a famous feminist, of course, Australian academic. What's it called? The
Female Unit.
Female Unit, thank you, yeah. But I mean, over the years, she's come in defending feminism, she seems to understand, has come very close to Catholic positions. In fact, she was taught by nuns. She wasn't a Catholic, but she was taught by nuns in Australia, old-fashioned nuns. And unlike some people say, oh, I was taught by nuns, they're all horrible sailors. She said, those women were my heroes. She said she had a bit of a difficult home life. She loved nuns, and I've seen her write now. She said, and the old ones still pray that I'll become a Catholic. And she's kind of almost, I saw a documentary, you know, somebody, the local vicar, where she lives in England, came out and said, elderly years now, came and knocked on her door asking for a collecting thing for the local parish church. She said, oh no, it's all right. I don't give money to those, I'm sorry. I said, you know, unless you're a Catholic, it's no point, you know, helping those other religions, they're no good. You know, so she's kind of like that. But of course, she's very outspoken against all the transgender thing, you know, because she thinks it's a plot to undermine women. To destroy the dignity of women, and she for speaking like that, this is probably about 10 years ago, they were going to give her an honorary doctorate at Old Cambridge College, and then that was dropped because of her controversial views that, you know, there are certain things that happen to ladies every month, that whatever you do to a man, that doesn't happen to that man. And, you know, there's things like that, the biological and psychological facts about being a woman cannot be denied, even if there are borderline cases, and so she's in big trouble. And Catherine Stock is a feminist, and she also promotes kind of causes that certainly aren't in accord with the Catholic view, but she's had quite a terrible persecution. She's now resigned from Sussex University because of her arguments, which are very cogent and very good, that there is such a thing as women, and the transgender thing is nonsense in every regard, in saying that, oh no, you know, man and woman are just one of 57 varieties of different genders. Mm. So, but what the problem here is that increasingly this is not only a closing down of people who have every qualification according to those social norms that we should recognise to be professors who, you know, the peer group, and they're trained and everything, they have, you know, they're not wacky lunatic fringe people, but they've been closed down in the name of no debate, no reason. And the blog that Dictation of Relativism, a blog that I go on quite regularly, I've done for some years, is an American philosophy blog by Brian Leiter. He's a professor of philosophy at Chicago, quite a distinguished philosopher of his own, and not at all religious, quite anti-religious, old-fashioned left-wing, you might say. But he's kind of up with, I like his blog because he has all sorts of philosophical news items about philosophy and things. And also, he and other people contribute to his blog from the Ivy League places in America, like Yale and Princeton and Harvard. They've all been worried, and they've been worried for some years, about what he calls the new infantilism, this closing down of debate and reasoning in universities. And I was even trying to find a clip. I remember he had a link to a video, it was probably maybe 5 years ago or something, about this philosopher at Princeton who, you know, these are not religious people or anything, and they're philosophers. The whole thing of philosophy since the ancient Greeks is to debate and reason and put forward a, but now it gets closed down. No, you can't debate reason because you're hurting my feelings. And you mustn't disagree with me, you know, you mustn't have, because that hurts me. And I must have my own feelings in my own. And that's the end of reason, it's the end. So that's a worrying place where we are. And he was on this video about Princeton, I think it was an ex-philosopher saying, well, what happens, of course, it's a money thing, that the the kids that go to Princeton, extremely well-off families. So, you know, it's the client. The client is paying thousands of dollars every year, so you've got to keep the clients happy. So those kids get upset with Professor X for challenging their views in the philosophy class and say, your view is, it doesn't, it has a contradiction in it, that hurts my feelings. Then, oh, you go with the kids, the administrators in the university, you don't upset them because they're the customers, they're giving all the money to the university. So it's a very dangerous, very certain place. It makes me think of a certain person who was an exile, who I think in Time magazine, it would have been 1941 or 42, wrote something to this effect, this person, this exile from his own country. He wrote, Time magazine, probably about 1941, 42, said, when the first kind of rabble-rousing Nazism, this kind of myth of a folk, you know, this kind of unreasonable bullying crowd, rabble-rousing ideology of Hitler got going in Germany in the late 20s and 30s, of course, gained ground because of the Wall Street crash. He said, I was sure that the men of the great men of the press, the great men of the German press, would tear it apart and would stop it. But he said that I saw them all cave into it and get taken over by this Nazi ideology, this irrational kind of emotional ideology of the people, of the folk. And he said, well, then I thought that the politicians of the other parties would stand up against this nonsense, this anti-reason. And then all the politicians gave way and caved into it, made compromises with it. And then I thought, well, the great men of the universities of Germany, of which I'm part of that world, he said, would stand up against this nonsense and denounce it. But then they all caved in. So the only institution in Germany that said anything against it and stood up against it was the Roman Catholic Church. And the person who wrote that in exile was Albert Einstein. And it kind of reminds me of the same sort of process today. The big dictatorship of relativism, this is what this phrase is from Pope Benedict XVI, who wrote and spoke a good deal of this threat to modern society. We can think of his wonderful address to the British Parliament, which, I mean, you have to watch the whole thing to appreciate it. God bless him, this chap on the right-hand side was the speaker. And the whole show, to get the whole show, you have to see his welcome address before you listen to Benedict. Because the welcome address, sophisticated, witty, a witty, wonderful celebration of what he considered a modern British relativism. Oh, debate and freedom, we'll never come to any, you know, it's all, you know, finding our way and discussing and who knows what's right and true, you know, and it's just that's our sophisticated British parliamentary life, our modern British society. And Pope Benedict, the university professor, very calmly, of this wonderful address, and in a way, he didn't know what he was going to say in front, even before that, but in a way, it was a wonderful, gentle demolition of that whole vision of the speaker. So, for example, he, in the address, he talks about celebrates the way that the British Parliament got rid of slavery in the British Empire by initially banning the slave trade after much debate in 1807, and then later in the 1830s, they, once you know. But he says, so that objective truth that men should not be the slaves of other men, was arrived at as a wonderful achievement by this very universe, by this very parliament, in where I'm standing now. This truth, which is true for all time, that it's wrong to accept, was arrived at in this parliament. What a wonderful achievement for all time and for all people. And then he talked about the conscience of Sir Thomas More, how Sir Thomas More had to go against the majority for the sake of truth, and go there, the very, where Paul, the Pope was speaking in Westminster Hall, was the very hall where Sir Thomas's trial took place, that witness to truth, that witness to that martyrdom for the truth. So those two examples were absolutely wonderful. And of course, this part of the theme of this dictatorship of relativism. And actually, that dictator of relativism that Benedict's phrase reminds me of Herbert Marcuse, who was a neo-Marxist, very popular in the 60s. His phrase was the tyranny of tolerance, that tolerance can be tyrannical. How is that so? Well, tyranny, what is tyranny? Tyranny is a rule, ruling, having authority over others, that a rule which is grossly contrary to reason or without reason. Thus, tyranny can be seen in shutting down or ignoring matters which should be debated and resolved for the good of people. So, you know, what Marcuse was saying in his own way, you know, tolerance, I don't mind, you don't mind people being killed or persecuted or tortured, you're open to anything. And of course, this is such a case of this is in our own country, in which there's that silent Holocaust, the issue of abortion, which is not discussed at all, which is just that's how you treat it. If ever somebody defending rights for the unborn appear and says this is murder and it's incredible damage to women who sadly get into doing this and people involved in this, that person is sort of presented as some kind of redneck or a figure of ridicule. Otherwise, we don't discuss this at all. And of course, the encouraging thing is in America is the overturning of Roe v. Wade in so many states. So that is a great thing. It's actually given a lot of impetus to the pro-life movement in this country to think that these things can change. Seems a long way off, but it seemed a long way off that anything would happen anywhere, or in America included, a few years ago, when I was growing up. And finally, this great remark of Chesterton. Chesterton saw this dictatorship of relativism years ago. Chesterton was a great prophet. He saw all this in the early 19th century. I suppose he could see all the strands of the culture already that were feeding into this river that we live in today. Chesterton saw this many years ago, and he said that when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, but they believe in any old thing. Nature abhors a vacuum. You know, you fill your head with any kind of unreasonable nonsense. This is the thing about faith and reason, really, and reason is the way we get to know the truth, and that truth we have to get to know and to live by it. And this is something that our Catholic faith upholds. I mean, this point is very important, that in the 18th century, you know, in the Enlightenment, very much, by the way, guess who called it the Enlightenment? These philosophers themselves. We're the enlightened ones, so surprise, surprise. And actually our phrase, the Middle Ages, is an 18th century invention, because the people who lived in the Middle Ages didn't think of themselves as living in the Middle Ages. The Enlightenment philosophers say, we're enlightened, we're reconnecting with all these wonderful Greek and Roman pagans who were clever in the past. And what happened in between was this dark period of Christian superstition and nonsense. That's the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. But now we're the Enlightenment again, and we're reconnecting, you know. So that was their story. And in the 18th century, it's very much this thing of, of course, the Protestant thing of faith is totally subjective and irrational feeds into this. Faith is superstitious nonsense, and that's to be left behind as humanity grows up, leaves that behind, and then reason will rule. And of course, what do we have? One of the effects of the Enlightenment is the bloodbath of the French Revolution, when the goddess of reason dances on the altars of the churches in Paris, and so reason now takes over and is into one series of executions after another, after another, and after another in France. And John Paul II says, well, no, what happens is that faith supports reason, and without faith, reason starts to go crumble or even turn against itself. And this really is what happened. We can see in the places of the universities which were given to the world by the Catholic Middle Ages, in the universities we see this even reason turning against itself. It's so true. And he says, you know, without faith, this rather than being the enemy of reason, faith supports reason. That's the Catholic vision.